From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actor James Earl Jones. His authoritative voice commands attention, but there was a time when he didn't want to be heard. Jones tells us about his stutter and why he virtually stopped speaking in public when he was growing up. Also today, artist Robert Irwin, one of the pioneers of the light and space movement of the 60s, talks with us about why he stopped painting and took up gambling. And commentator Gail Pemberton remembers the event that galvanized the civil rights movement 30 years ago today. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
No public radio news in Washington. I'm Corey Flintoff. The Clinton administration sought to reassure health care providers today that new reform measures won't force them into violating federal antitrust laws. The administration plan would reportedly try to hold down health care costs by encouraging providers to work together and share some of their resources. At a news conference today, First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton and Attorney General Janet Reno laid out six areas under current regulations where providers could work together without violating antitrust rules. As an example, Reno said that a group of doctors could get together to buy expensive equipment, such as a CAT scan machine. A senior State Department official told Congress today Macedonia has tightened enforcement of economic sanctions on its border with Serbia. The UN imposed sanctions against the former Yugoslavia to try to end Serbian aggression. NPR's Ann Garrels has more.
As late as this summer, Macedonia had, in the words of sanctions inspectors, leaked like a sieve. Dozens of trucks crossed into Serbia each night, carrying everything from piping and bricks to food and fuel. Macedonia, once part of the former Yugoslavia, is dependent on trade with Serbia. But it's come under diplomatic pressure to tighten sanctions, and Assistant Secretary of State Stephen Oxman told a congressional hearing today monitors had reported unprecedented cooperation in the last 2 weeks. Lee Hamilton, chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, warned should there be a peace accord in Bosnia, Congress would not easily agree to U.S. participation in a peacekeeping force. Oxman said, U.S. participation is essential. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
A 23-year hunt for an anti-war activist implicated in a bank robbery and the murder of a Boston policeman is finally over. Catherine Ann Power surrendered to state and federal officials today. Anthony Brooks of member station WBUR reports from Boston.
At one time, Catherine Power was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list for driving the getaway car in a 1970 Boston bank robbery that resulted in the murder of police officer Walter Schroeder. Although her four accomplices were eventually captured, Power evaded arrest, moving around the country and eventually settling in Oregon under an assumed name. Her attorney, Ricky Kleeman, says after 23 years, Power had finally had enough.
She decided that she really needed to get rid of her guilt that she's carried around and to lead a single life instead of the double life which she's led all these years.
Under a plea bargain, Power pleaded guilty to manslaughter and armed robbery. Prosecutors say the deal closes one of the city's and the country's most visible cases related to radical anti-war activism. Powers will be sentenced October 6th. This is Anthony Brooks in Boston.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 18 points to close at 3,633.65. This is NPR News. Norwegian officials say that three hijackers have now released all 10 women and 7 children aboard a Russian jetliner they forced to fly from South Russia to Oslo. The hijackers are believed to be Iranians who boarded the plane in Azerbaijan and threatened the crew with grenades and explosives. Police said the hijackers want asylum in Norway. Ukrainian and Azerbaijani officials said the hijackers were Iranians who were linked to the radical Hezbollah militia in Lebanon, but Norwegian officials won't confirm that. At the United Nations, the General Assembly has voted to elect an American to be one of the judges who will preside over the International War Crimes Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. The Assembly chose former District Court Judge Gabrielle Kirk McDonald of Texas. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
As one of the 11 judges on the tribunal, MacDonald will preside over the trials of those accused of murder, rape, torture, and other atrocities in the former Yugoslavia. The court will be based in The Hague, and each judge will serve a 4-year term. But as of now, it's unclear how busy the judges will ultimately be. The War Crimes Tribunal does not have the power to extradite suspects from the former Yugoslavia. Instead, the court will investigate and issue indictments. Trials will only be held if a suspect travels outside of the former Yugoslavia and is arrested, or if the different combatants hand over their captured enemies. Meanwhile, the Security Council still hasn't agreed on a prosecutor. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
In Somalia today, 11 people were injured in a daylight attack on the United Nations headquarters building in Mogadishu. A UN spokesman said the mortar attack was launched by gunmen believed to be supporters of clan leader Mohamed Farah Aidid. Italy's defense ministry said that 2 Italian soldiers were also killed today in an ambush that was blamed on Aidid's militia. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. James Earl Jones has a voice that conveys power and authority. He was the voice of Darth Vader in Star Wars. Now he's the voice of the CNN logo. So it surprised me to read in his new memoir about all the trouble his voice has caused him. In his new memoir, Voices and Silences, he writes about his personal life and his career on stage in such plays as The Blacks, The Blood Knot, The Great White Hope, Othello, and Fences. In films such as Field of Dreams, Coming to America, and Summersby. And on TV, including his own series, Gabriel's Fire. Jones grew up in rural Mississippi. His family moved to rural Michigan when he was still a boy. In retrospect, he credits this uprooting with causing his stutter. As a child, the stutter was very bad. In fact, there was a period between the ages of 6 and 14 when he barely spoke at all.
I did the basics. I was able to function as a farm kid, doing all those chores where you call animals. I think I had my best conversations with the dog, who was a good friend of mine and didn't challenge me in any way. I certainly let the family know what my needs were. But when strangers came to the house, the mute happened. I didn't want to confront them. I wasn't ready. I hid in the state of muteness.
Did you not want to speak, or did you feel physically unable to speak?
It was just too embarrassing.
Because of the stutter?
And too difficult, yeah. I want to say that in spite of the fact that recently here in the police files of New York, there was a tragedy. A man, they feel, who was afraid he'd get a bad, job report, because he was a stutterer, ended up killing somebody, including himself, and wounding his supervisor. So there's some serious framework around the problem of stuttering, but it, at the same time, although it is totally incorrect for me to say this, politically incorrect, stutterers are very funny. I mean, when I evoked laughter in the Sunday school class from the kids behind me because I stuttered, I understood that. I understand how funny it is, but it's also very painful, you know.
Well, what were some of the things that adults or friends did to try to coax you to talk more?
No, they left me alone. My family had a habit of letting me have my way a lot when it came to sometimes major life decisions. But when it was about me, they let me decide. And that was one of them, when I wanted to leave the church, leave Sunday school, leave the religion because of the stuttering and because of the kids laughing. They accepted that. You know.
Even though your grandmother was very religious.
Oh, boy, was she ever. She's, she was a triple born again. You know.
Can you tell us the story of how you started speaking again?
Donald Crouch was an associate of...
Donald Crouch was your teacher?
Yeah, Robert Frost. He was a college professor, but he ended up in this high school because he retired. He was a Mennonite farmer, and he retired to his farm in Brethren, Michigan. And the idea that there were kids down the road at this high school who were studying Chaucer and Shakespeare and stuff, he couldn't stand it. So he came back and taught high school, you know. He was the first English teacher I had. Now, see, I'm stuttering again. He was the first English teacher I had, and he accepted that I wasn't verbal, that I wasn't oral, but he didn't like the idea that I could privately, subjectively enjoy poetry and not sound it out loud. He one day discovered that I wrote poetry, and he said to me, this poem is so good, I don't think you really wrote it. I think you plagiarized it, which was a shock to me. I could admit that it was Longfellow-esque, but it was not certainly stolen from Longfellow. And he said, the way you can prove it to me that you wrote it was to get up in front of the class and recite it by heart. And I accepted the challenge and did it, and we both realized then we had a means, we had a way of regaining the power of speech through reading poetry.
What was it about having words written down for you that made it easier for you to speak?
Really? Not that they were written down, but they're rhythmic. I think you'll find many stutterers today. I'm trying to think of the country western singer who is a stutterer, but does not stutter when he sings. But there are many, many cases like Mel Tillis. Thank you. Thank you, Mel Tillis. And there are many cases like that, actors, singers who don't have that problem when they are performing. Walk off stage and you can't understand the word they're saying. It had to do with the rhythm. Rhythm carries us through. It does not. It smooths out those areas that allow the log jamming and the stuttering to be triggered.
Mm-hmm. So how does the stutter come back very much for you?
You've heard it several times. Mm-hmm. Now, it's always with me. You know. And I have to be careful not to talk too fast.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly becomes a problem whenever I do something emotional, whether in real life or as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
I hit an emotional speech, whether it's a positive emotion or a negative,
yeah.
Joy or pain. And that often leads to overload, and I have to be very careful. There was a time when my acting was affected by it. I think Gladys Vaughn was the first to notice it. She says, when you get emotional, when your Othello, for instance, gets emotional, I sometimes believe you less, and it's because I'm being too careful. You can't measure out emotion; it has a flow.
Has your Othello ever stuttered?
No, none of my characters have ever stuttered, except for the very first thing I did on Broadway. I played the role of Edward, FDR's houseboy, valet, as a young man, I had the line, "Mrs. Roosevelt, supper is served," and I got hung on the mama word. And it is funny, isn't it? But because it's so ridiculous. Mary Thicket, who was playing Eleanor Roosevelt, was very patient. She just stood there and let me get through it. She knew, the audience knew, that something was wrong. But she didn't want to embarrass me any further by saying my line for me.
Right.
So she let me have my moment. I got through it, and it's never happened since.
Now, what was it like in your early days as an actor before you had the reputation, before you were James Earl Jones? And you'd go and talk to a casting director, and you'd be stuttering when talking to them, and then you'd have to somehow convince them that on stage you were going to be fine. I mean, casting directors, I'm sure, are pretty insecure about that kind of thing.
No, there was never a problem. I don't know why, but it never was. Marlon Brando and all the method actors had made stuttering a part of the way Americans talk.
Oh, a part of, like, emotional truth that you're grasping so hard for truth. Yeah. If you're just joining us, my guest is James Earl Jones. He's written a new autobiography called Voices and Silences. Could you give us a sense of the kinds of exercises or the type of training that you had that helped you find the power in your voice? Because you have a very powerful voice.
Oh, the exercises were, I got to move back a bit.
Okay.
Sweet, peek, peek, peek. Hog calling. Uh-huh. Cattle calling.
That's something you did on the farm without having to go to a voice.
My dad always said that the reason he became an actor was because even in grade school, and he didn't have a whole lot of it, but even in grade school, he was the loudest kid in class.
From calling the animals.
So he was destined to be an actor. So, and that's kind of true, though. Farm kids are never told, hush, you wake the neighbors. Farm kids are told, use your voice to get those cows in here.
So you think you developed that power on the farm?
Long before acting class?
Yeah. And also, it is also genetic. I inherited whatever resonating chambers my father possesses. They're not too dissimilar from Paul Robeson and another actor of my generation, Jeffrey Holder.
Mm-hmm.
So when the Darth Vader voice became a mystery, people thought, as many people thought it was Jeffrey Holder as who thought it was me. And that has to do with just how a voice is produced, you know, how it
resonates in the head and everything.
Yeah, in the head and in the body.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think some of the advice that your voice teacher gave you was to not use the full power of your voice, just to save some of it in reserve.
Well, that's just good acting. Once you take your character to the limit, the the audience can tell that he has no more. There's nothing in reserve, and they get less interested. There's less suspense about what you're going to do next, you know?
So do you know where your limit is and how to go just short of that?
I just got off the set of a show we did in Richmond, Virginia. And the very last day, I remember yelling at the director for the first time. I wanted to yell at him a lot, but I was rehearsing a scene with Mary Alice, in which...
I like her a lot.
Yeah, me too. And I felt lucky that she was able to join that cast and playing my wife again, playing Mrs. Altona Johns to my Vernon Johns. And she was going up the stairs, having admitted that she just allowed our oldest daughter to get on a segregated bus. And in my outrage, I flip out about it. Well, in my rehearsal, I flipped out to the peak of my voice, and the director was about to say, I don't think it should be that loud. I said, shut up, leave me alone, let us find our way. You know, and I was very rude to him. But yeah, he was about to remind me that you can't do it at the peak. You got to leave something in reserve, and I knew that. But sometimes I have to test the walls myself, test the you know, what the space can hold myself, you know, and not go on a theory.
So when you were yelling at the director, were you using the full power?
yeah. I tested the limits of the set with him too. Yeah.
Now, your father was an actor. He was a boxer first, then he became an actor.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like your family wasn't really proud of that. I mean, you were raised by your grandparents. They didn't seem at all proud.
They would have been proud. They became later proud of Joe Louis. I think my grandfather was secretly proud of Jack Johnson as he was of Satchel Paige, the baseball player.
What about the acting part of his career? It sounds like you're...
What I'm getting at is they just didn't understand it.
Right.
It was hard enough for them to understand a prize fighter making a real honest living.
Yeah.
Much less a troubadour actor. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was just not within the comprehension. These are people who we got our life from the soil. And I'm very proud of that. That I had that I shared that kind of life with them, but they had no way of understanding Robert Earl,
right?
And were very intolerant of him, and very resistant to my ever meeting him. I didn't get to meet him until I was 21, until I was legal age, and my mother was a part of that too. It was a very bad marriage, and which I tried to explain in the book and tried to show both sides.
I guess that's part of the reason why you ended up being brought up by your grandparents.
Oh, that was the reason they. My mother wanted to be a single mother, but my grandmother knew better, that during the Depression it was hard enough for her, a 20-year-old girl, to, you know, manage her own life. And she insisted that she found a way to adopt me.
My guest is James Earl Jones. He's written a new memoir called Voices and Silences. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. James Earl Jones is my guest. In your memoir, Voices and Silences, you devote a total of about a paragraph to Star Wars, to your voice as Darth Vader. And I got the impression that
It's not something you really want to call that much attention to.
Are you kidding? Not true. It's just that I have very little to talk about.
Okay.
Had I been one of the actors and given points, I would not only be wealthy, I'd be probably much better known.
You got a flat fee?
Oh, yeah. I think George Lucas, first of all, realized that although David Prowse was the actor he wanted, it was not the sound he wanted. So he searched around for a technically and symbolically a darker voice.
Mm-hmm.
He eventually came to me and said to Lucy, would Jenny like to earn a day's salary? The job took 2.5 hours. They paid me all of $9,000, which was not bad for 2.5 hours of work.
Right.
None of us knew what we had,
right.
You know, and that was fine. Almost not out of embarrassment, but out of his traditionally his non-traditional capitalism or lack of capitalism, George gave me a Christmas bonus that amounted to the same amount of money. But I was just acting as special effects. That's all that was.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I was having done the Great White Hope film. I'd become a member of the board of directors of the Oscar board, you know, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, at a time when the controversy over whether Mercedes McCambridge deserved credit for her contributions to the Linda Blair's voice, the devil coming
in The Exorcist.
Yeah, and The Exorcist. And I thought there was a silly argument that I said to myself that all the Mercedes is special effects. And I wanted to keep that clear in my case, so I didn't even take credit for the voice of Darth Vader.
Forgive me, I know this is a small part of your career, but I have to ask you about the CNN voice. The first time someone said to me, you know, I think that's James Earl Jones, I said, nah. You know, I was, no, they're right. And of course, everybody knows this now, that you do the voice of CNN. Why did you decide to take that on when you were offered it?
You asked me what is the Star Wars involvement meant to me. What it did, it made my voice viable in the commercial world. But I don't know why. Really, I avoided that great way to make a living and great craft unto itself. But the Star Wars sort of put my name on the A list, as they say out there, for authoritative voices.
So your attitude was, why not take advantage of it?
My attitude?
Yeah.
Oh, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, why kick something that's going to sit on your lap out of the house? I mean, I think the first commercials I did one for Chrysler and one for Goodyear and one for Fisher products, audio products. And they asked me to just give us the sound of God. Goodyear Vector tires, you know. Let God sell Goodyear Vector tires.
No problem.
They were not embarrassed about saying that, you know.
So, do you have a voice of yours that you think of the voice of God?
No. It just the sound is let it go as bass as it can go and still be clear.
Yeah.
And to sound like I mean it. And there's not a product I've ever promoted that I don't use, including Wells Lamont gloves, working man's gloves.
Of course, the Yellow Pages.
And Ruben's dinners out in Ruben's chain of restaurants. Orson Welles and Vincent Price and I were once asked to simply, on a recording, read the menu. With as much slobbering, lustful sounds as we can conjure. And we got paid for it.
When you were getting started as an actor in, was it the 50s or the 60s that we're talking about?
It was the 50s.
50s, yeah. Was it hard for you as an African-American actor to find roles?
I laugh because I never want to contribute to the truth or the mythology about racism in this country in terms of the arts. There is some truth. My father warned me of that. I think each generation gets better. But I don't want to lay the fault at the door of race. I think anybody who's as talented as, I'll name you two or three, Courtney Vance, Forest Whitaker, these young actors, anybody that talented, no matter how black they are, will never be denied long. The talent will break. You know, Marlon Brando wasn't all that fancy a person. Kid from the Midwest, right? But there's no way to keep that talent from I mean, Hollywood is a money-making machine. And if you get enough, say, so-called black movies going, and they make a lot of money, you better believe Hollywood's going to be right there to hire those actors, as they are doing with Denzel Washington,
well,
in non-traditional ways, because it's called box office.
I think you're being very, very modest here, but
no, I'm
but
being,
really,
I'm
I mean, being, when you started
I'm
acting,
careful
there were...
not to discourage young black people.
Oh, no, I understand.
From expressing themselves in artistic ways because it's hard. But, it is hard.
But Hollywood did not have the faith in African Americans at the box office that they're
Hollywood
starting to
have,
develop now.
Hollywood didn't have faith in women, Hispanic Americans. Asian Americans,
yeah.
Native Americans. It has no faith at all. It's not about faith. It's about habits, fads, spinoffs, sequels. You know, Hollywood has some very bad habits, and a lot of them are racist. But I don't want to discourage kids from going bashing at the doors.
You're, I'm sure, doing a lot of interviews now on the occasion of your new memoir, Voices and Silences. In thinking back, I don't think I've heard you interviewed a lot on television, though.
Good.
Good. Well, I'm wondering if that was a choice at all, and if you've ever been shy about speaking in public.
No, I admire actors who make it a choice not to give interviews. I really admire that. But sometimes you make a business deal with a producer, or in this case, a publisher.
Oh, where it's part of the deal to sell the movie and go on tour.
You got it. I mean,
why'd
you even do the book if you didn't want it to be read by somebody? And I'm very, very happy to have had the chance to talk about it and myself and things with you today.
Well, have you done a lot of interviews in the past? Have I just missed it, or?
Whenever I do a TV series, there's always that period when you got to do the junkets, you know,
right?
And you got to get out there and as John Huston said, you got to get out there and whore. You got to get out there and whore for your product, whore for your baby, you know.
One quick, very quick last question: have you ever been in a kind of difficult situation, either on the verge of being mugged or given a traffic ticket that you didn't want to pay, or something where you used your big authoritative voice to intimidate the other person?
Last time I was mugged, it was multiple muggings, because my first visit to St. Louis, Missouri, at the age of 14, I was mugged several times one afternoon before I figured it out what was going on. And in those days, you didn't always get killed when you got mugged.
Right.
You got surrounded by a bunch of kids. They said, give me your money. I said, okay. Being a farm kid, why, you fight over some movie change? The idea of fighting didn't occur to me. So therefore, I was quite safe. The only time I've used the voice, though, in my adult life was when I got my first CB radio, and I used the Darth Vader as my handle. Panicked a few people on the cross-country drive from New York to Los Angeles, and I've not done it since.
That's very funny. James Earl Jones, I thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you immensely.
Thank you.
James Earl Jones has written a new memoir called Voices and Silences. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a former painter's obsession with the space around the painting. We talk with artist Robert Irwin about why he started creating pieces that play with light and space, and what he learned from gambling. The Los Angeles Museum of Contemporary Art recently organized a retrospective of his work. Also, 30 years ago today, four young girls were killed in what became known as the Birmingham bombing. Commentator Gail Pemberton reflects on the event that galvanized the civil rights movement. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. The State Department says Americans should not travel to Somalia, and U.S. citizens already in the country should avoid the capital Mogadishu. The department says it's received reports that Americans may be taken hostage if Somali warlord Mohamed Farah Aidid is captured. Somali attacks against U.N. facilities continue today. Mortars hit the U.N. peacekeeping compound, wounding 11 people, including one American officer. Norwegian officials say a group of hijackers who diverted a Russian airliner to an airport near Oslo today are asking for political asylum. A few hours ago, the hijackers released 12 women and children. Tony Samstag has more from Oslo.
The aircraft landed at 8:15 p.m. local time at Gardermoen Airport, about 20 kilometers from the capital, with 45 passengers, including children, and a crew of six aboard. The airport has been sealed off, and a medical helicopter has flown to the scene. Men thought to be armed with explosives hijacked the plane during a flight from the Azerbaijani capital Baku to the Russian city of Perm, forcing it to land at the Ukrainian capital Kiev before demanding to be flown to Norway. The hijackers have been variously described as Muslim fundamentalists or Iranians with links to the Hezbollah movement. Gardermoen Airport is one of two airports serving the Norwegian capital. The decision to land there instead of the more central Fornebu, which is virtually a suburb of Oslo, no more than 10 minutes' drive from the center, was almost certainly strategic. Gardermoen is shared by military and civilian aircraft, and the Russian plane is now in the military sector.
Tony Samstag for the BBC. The Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission have drawn up new antitrust guidelines for doctors and hospitals considering mergers and joint ventures to cut costs. NPR's Carolyn Clark Kelly reports.
The new guidelines set up safety zones for healthcare providers, areas in which they can share equipment and information on procedures and prices, but still steer clear of antitrust violations. First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton says under the new guidelines, consumers will pay less.
Equipment will not stand idle. It will be used more frequently. Hospitals will save money. The pressure on physicians to order tests to pay for the machinery that they bought in order to be competitive will stop.
Officials stress the guidelines are clarifications and not changes in existing antitrust policies. Attorney General Janet Reno says if doctors and hospitals still have questions about whether a practice is legal, they can contact her department or the FTC and get an answer within 90 days. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
An early frost today damaged corn and soybean crops in parts of the plains and Midwest. A few towns in Iowa, Nebraska, and Minnesota had temperatures in the 20s. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials gained nearly 18 points. This is NPR. A new report says ultrasound screening for women with low-risk pregnancies is unnecessary and increases health care costs by about $1 billion a year. The study by Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston involved more than 15,000 women across the country. Researchers found ultrasound tests made no difference in how their pregnancies turned out. Americans are generally healthier than ever, according to the government's 17th annual report on the country's health status. But even so, the report found great disparities among different racial and age groups. NPR's Brenda Wilson has more.
The average American can now look forward to living to be more than 75 years old. That's a 2-year improvement over the last decade. That's because more are exercising, fewer are smoking, and cholesterol levels are dropping. So while heart disease, strokes, and cancer remain the leading causes of death, they're striking later in life. But there are other alarming trends affecting younger Americans and minority groups. Infant mortality rates are down to an all-time low, but black infants are still twice as likely to die in their first year. Homicide rates among 15 to 24-year-olds have doubled over the last 5 years, and more Americans are dying from AIDS each year. Health and Human Services Secretary Donna Shalala says the disparities make the case for health reform.
Fundamentally, we need to take this huge expenditure that we have for health care and to shake it up and reshuffle it, which is essentially what the president's plan does, to make sure everyone gets coverage.
In Washington, I'm Brenda Wilson.
The Education Department says many American students read so poorly they can't understand material considered basic for their grade level. Education Secretary Richard Riley said much of the blame falls on parents who let their kids watch too much TV. The report said children who score highest on reading tests watch 3 hours or less of TV every night. Students scoring the lowest watched 6 hours or more. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Robert Irwin is an artist whose work is often about perception. He used to be a painter, but he gave up painting and his studio by 1970 and became one of the pioneers of a movement that investigated the nature of light and space. He turned to public artworks, though many of his ideas were too controversial to get past the proposal stage. He's created works for a public park in Dallas, the old post office in Washington, D.C., and the Public Safety Building Plaza in Seattle. He's currently designing the Central Garden for the Getty Museum in Los Angeles. He's one of the most influential California artists, and the Museum of Contemporary Art in L.A. recently organized his first major retrospective, which will soon travel. New Yorker writer Lawrence Weschler devoted a book to Irwin and his work. Weschler describes Irwin as one of the most interestingly and fruitfully contradictory figures on the art scene today. I asked Robert Irwin what he thinks his work is about.
Actually, I would say the probably central element of my whole activity is the quality of questions. I'm kind of a question addict. My whole interest is in positing questions which I think are relevant and then pursuing whatever conclusions they may arrive at.
What kinds of questions do you think your art asks?
Well, I think that art is actually an activity which is not dissimilar to philosophy, in which it asks those rather broad questions as to what is the nature of things? What is the nature of reality? What do we mean by meaning? Things of those sorts. And with a kind of bias towards the aesthetic, that is an interest in the fact that everything has a potential beauty to it. So perception overlaps that, obviously, in that when I'm making inquiries as to how we see the world and why we see the world the way we do and why do we make the assumptions we do, why do we assign the kind of meanings we do, we get involved with the whole idea of how one perceives the world and the kind of that philosophic question of the fact that we make the world, we form the world, the kind of intentionality that is, I think, central to contemporary philosophy.
Can you give me an example of a specific piece or a specific proposal that you feel illustrates how your art poses such questions?
Well, I think no one single piece does it, but I think if you look at the sort of trajectory of what I've been doing, there's a kind of continuous thread, which is this series of questions which are interlocked. My feeling is that that art, a long time ago, modern art, developed its philosophic ground. That's fairly understandable now. It has developed a conceptual ground, which is, I think, reasonably understood by people. It has, in the last 50 years, developed a vocabulary, a language, a syntax, and we're at a point in time where we're trying to test those ideas, those issues, those philosophies, those concepts in the world to find out whether or not they hold water. What kind of a world do they make? And that's really what I'm trying to do right now. So I'm sort of in this funny, awkward place, halfway in one foot in the art world and one foot in the world of you know, day-to-day actually building things.
Now, I know you gave up your studio in 1970, and you stopped painting before that. Do you remember what your last painting was?
Yeah, sure. There were the disc paintings that I did. There were these circular convex paintings that were painted in a way so that they became a piece and a part of the environment around them. They were no longer objects separated from that environment. I was trying to paint a painting that didn't begin and end at the edge. And when I accomplished that, I was no longer a painter. I had to deal with the space around it and take all that seriously.
When you gave up painting, did you miss the pleasure of paint, the color
Absolutely.
Of paint?
Absolutely. More, even more critically, I missed having what I did not realize. I missed having a very clearly defined thinking form. I mean, I that's how I thought about things. That's how I organized things. I used the painting as the kind of crucible in which I put all those things and mixed them around and looked at them and examined them. And when I stopped being a painter and not knowing where I'm going to go, I ran into the problem that I did not know how to think about the things that I did. So the first thing I had to do was spend a couple of years examining just that. How do I essentially posit my own questions? How do I examine my own assumptions and so on and so forth?
You've made a living not only through your art but through teaching. And for a while, I think you made a living betting on horses. What period of your life was that?
Well, first of all, I made a living teaching in a very, very short period of time. I only taught for about 5 or 6 years. I found it an incredibly interesting activity. In fact, it was really a full-time job. It was if I wanted to do what I'm doing, I couldn't also teach. So that was a loss in a way. I rather enjoyed that very much. As an alternative, one of the things that I started, I got involved when gambling essentially when I was 15, and I'm not quite sure why. Maybe the people I was hanging out with. But it became my first real opportunity to think something all the way through. The beauty of, for example, horse racing is that when you find an activity in which the information is infinitely complex, one of the first things you find yourself doing is essentially corrupting it, because it is totally corruptible. You can make it do or appear to be anything you want it to be, which was my first lesson, i.e. in intentionality, that you intend that world. And so the first lesson in gambling is self-control. And that was a big surprise to me, because gambling from the outside looks like a kind of catharsis, a letting loose. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why you can win at gambling, because most of the people who gamble want to lose. The camaraderie, it's much easier, it's more friendlier, a letting go. To win at something, to be disciplined enough to really think something through, is very complex and separates you in a lot of social ways. And so it became my first really good philosophic lesson was learning how to do it. It's like a three-dimensional chess game. And if you really are interested in the quality of the game, you also have to be interested in the quality of how one pursues the game.
I always get scared when people gamble, because for me, gambling always brings to mind B-movies in which the main character gambles away everything and ends up destitute in an alcoholic stupor on Skid Row. And I always wonder, well, didn't you see any of those films? Don't you know this can only end badly?
That's what my mother always thought.
And was she persuasive?
No, not at all. Actually, I found that everyone needs at some time a real strong discipline in their lives, something which allows you to really carefully sort out and value all the different kinds of things that you bring to bear on your decision-making process, and also on how you conduct your own life. Oddly enough, gambling for me was essentially that crucible, that process of disciplining myself. Some people might do it with an instrument, playing a piano and having to practice every single day, or someone might do it, using any kind of tool, like painting as a discipline of sorts. I found gambling actually to be a much more active one.
Artist Robert Irwin is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is artist Robert Irwin. You grew up in Los Angeles. What visually excited you when you were growing up? What kinds of things?
I had a real great interest in the just the quality of the way things look. Specifically, I was really interested in automobiles, building, you know, having my first car, painting it, polishing it, working on it, refining the linkage of the carburetor, that sort of thing. So that was my first sort of craft participation. And the second one, I think, was learning how to dance. There was a great interest in what was called jitterbugging or lindying. And I couldn't do it in the beginning at all. I had to spend like a year dancing with a doorknob, sort of learning how to do this thing, which I found ultimately really, I danced every single night and made a living dancing in contests. And that was a real pleasure. And that, I think, probably was my my most sensual kind of activity.
Well, that's interesting. With the cars.
Curious.
With the cars, did you customize your cars?
Oh, sure. The first car I owned, I had it a year before I was allowed to drive it. I think it's something that people grow up with out here in California. Mm-hmm. And a car becomes something more complex than just a piece of transportation. There's a, especially in those days when a car was more manipulable, I mean, you could make it and build it and change it and that. It was a really, you know, your first sort of hands-on aesthetic experience where you made decisions, like I say, about the linkage of the carburetor. That's fundamentally an aesthetic. It's actually, I tried to explain to some people at one time that I think that's an authentic folk art. We think of folk arts as being Indian blankets and pots and that. Those are now have become historical arts. In this contemporary time, say for a kid growing up in California, an automobile was the utilitarian object that you start out with, and you make it yours. You identify it in all the ways so that it is exactly a kind of representation of how you think you are.
So what's the coolest customized car that you had? What did you do that was really...
Well, I first of all, I was very limited in the amount of monies that I had at that time. My parents were not able to help me out in that, so it was only what I was able to earn, but probably the one I had that I got to the highest level was a 34 five-window coupe, which I got so that it looked, I thought, looked pretty good to myself. And a little bit of show, a little bit of go.
When you started getting interested in art, did you get involved in looking at art through the avant-garde of the time or through the older, already acknowledged great works?
Well, my education, as I said earlier, was very poor in that my exposure to the world was minimal out on the West Coast. I think probably my first experience of seeing something that maybe had a real art content was actually seeing rakubos, Japanese, these very special Japanese wares, these small little tea bowls. And I had never, I did not take any courses in art history, nor did I really go to the museum. My first exposure to contemporary painting and that was with these other artists that were around me. And then slowly I began to start seeing these other things. At one point I decided that I had a great void there, a great need. So I decided to teach myself something about art history and took over a whole area of the library at UCLA during one summer. And there was nobody there and laid out the sort of history of art in pictures on tables. And then walked up and down, rather than reading about it or looking at it in terms of text, I looked at it visually and walked up and down these things for like literally 3 months. And then went off to Europe and looked at the things firsthand. Went to, you know, Spain and Italy and France and spent a lot of time in the museums. And then had a kind of moment where in the Louvre, I was walking through and looking at all these paintings and examining them. And they had an unusual exhibition of a pointillist painting there at that particular moment, and I was standing in a room full of 18th century work and looked into this other room of this pointillist thing, and suddenly that other room was totally alive, and I realized I had while all that 18th century, 17th, all that was very interesting, that's not where my heart was. So I went into that pointillist room and realized I somehow was a part of the modern world.
You sound very, very methodical, even in your approach to art.
Well, I guess I do have a kind of methodical. I don't think of myself being that way, but I've learned how to think something from the beginning and slowly develop it all the way through, which I think maybe is my one of my best strengths.
Do you go to museums anymore?
Oh yeah, sure, not in the sense of being methodical. I go and. give my eye a holiday, have fun, just look at stuff and don't get critical about it, just look at it. And the things that please me, I look at a long time, and the things that don't, I don't pay much attention to.
I'd like to go back to some of your early passions, customized cars and dance. Do you still dance? If so, what kind of dances do you do, and what kind of car do you drive now?
Well, the thread is not very is pretty thin now. I don't dance much right now. The only dance that I really learned how to do was I was like a contest jitterbug dancer, which had this element in it, which is called a shoulder twist, which allows you to kind of develop a kind of counterpoint with your partner that gives you almost the feeling that you're going to fly, that you're going to literally almost come off the ground. And when you're doing it, you think you're Fred Astaire for a moment, and it's a great feeling, very satisfying. But there aren't very many people who do that anymore, and it's very hard to find a partner. And that music no longer really, the kind of rhythm, that sort of big band sound doesn't really exist all that much anymore. So that's a pretty vague situation. Cars, I guess I'm still slightly addicted in the sense that the car I have has a certain look to it, and I keep it polished and clean. Some people think a little obsessively, so I don't feel I'm not that involved anymore. But in fact, when I'm in my car with the sunroof back and looking out over the black hood, I like it to be shiny.
What kind of car is it?
It's a 1982 Eldorado, a black on black, which is sort of the last, in a way, to me, almost one of the last American hot rods. Everything else has become European in design, that sort of a flowing design. This still has a kind of hard edge to it, and I like that look, and I'm having a hard time replacing. The car's gotten 150,000 miles on it now, and I can't find anything to replace it with.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Artist Robert Irwin. The Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles recently organized a retrospective of his work. The catalog is published by Rizzoli. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, the Republicans have unveiled a health reform proposal as an alternative to the Clinton plan. We'll have a report on that. Also, the Congress has at least temporarily taken away the ban on using Medicaid funding for abortion, although there's some thought they may put it back. Also, fighting in Georgia in the old Soviet Union, where Shevardnadze is attempting to get control of his country, fighting in old Yugoslavia between Croatians and Serbians, and a terrible story of a massacre in central Bosnia. We'll also look at a new book called The Late Man and Sinister Poetry.
Thanks, Linda. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Today marks the 30th anniversary of the Birmingham bombing, when white supremacists dynamited the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. The explosion killed four young black girls. It's one of those events that has for most receded in history, but commentator Gail Pemberton remembers the bombing and other frightening events that defined the times.
One sunny October morning at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis, my high school was locked. There were about 300 students standing outside, but practically no one was talking. When the principal appeared with a bullhorn, we held our breaths. Turns out the janitor was late. I can still feel the collective sigh of relief and the slow, swelling sound of teenagers beginning to talk and laugh. The bomb didn't drop then, but there were others, real and metaphorical ones, that did throughout the decade. In 1963, I was 15 years old, black, living in the Middle West, and I was nervous and fitful. It seemed to me that every supposed victory in the battle for civil rights was countered by white supremacists with ghastly murders, assassinations, venomous rhetoric, and on more than one occasion, dynamite. No day was more disturbing than September 15th of that year. That was the Sunday when the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama was bombed, and Addie Mae Collins, Carol Robertson, Cynthia Wesley, and Denise McNair died. Watching the television bulletin announcing the bombing of the church, my family, like millions of others, sat frozen and speechless. Three of the girls were just a year younger than I, the fourth even younger. Their deaths were not, for me, a shattering of some kind of innocence. I knew children died and that people filled with hatred would murder, but it was still too difficult to handle. In a manner I was to repeat 2 months later, after the assassination of President Kennedy, I found myself glued to the television, wanting to see and then covering my eyes to the sight of the carnage and the agony of the families and their friends. No amount of outrage from government or civil rights officials, preachers or teachers, could alleviate the awful combination of anger, pain, and numbness I felt about the bombing. There was no sense to be made of so singularly evil an event. What did Carol, Cynthia, Addie Mae, and Denise want to grow up to be, I wondered. I knew that I hadn't a clue of what I wanted to grow up to be, as if knowing that somehow would make the dying less tragic. Their deaths proved to me, as nothing else ever had, that there was no safe place from racial hatred, no home, no school, and after September 15th, no church. For many following Sundays, I was afraid as I put on my choir robe and processed into my church. It didn't matter that I was 1,000 miles away from Birmingham, or that my church was Episcopalian, not Baptist, or that we sang hymns, rarely spirituals, and never gospel music. Fear was precisely what the murderers wanted all black people in the country to feel. Perhaps it was because the bombing was in a church that our fear evolved into a stronger determination to fight for the civil rights Addie Mae, Carol, Cynthia, and Denise would never know. By the end of the 60s, I was in college. I remember Joan Baez's rendition of Birmingham Sunday, a sweet lyrical lament written by the late Richard Farina. It would waft through dormitory halls, and voices, including mine, would sing along. A line from the song goes, "On Birmingham Sunday, a noise shook the ground, and people all over the earth turned around, for no one recalled a more cowardly sound, and the choir kept singing of freedom." It has been a long 30 years, and today I've turned around again. Those four young girls must have dreamed of a better world than the one they had. I know I did. And there is much to be said by their unwitting martyrdom to the cause of justice. Racism still exists in our country. We have a great amount of work to do. And I'm sure there are many Americans who either do not know of the bombing or who have forgotten it. But on this, the 30th anniversary, let us remember Addie Mae Collins, Carol Robertson, Cynthia Wesley, and Denise McNair.
Gail Pemberton is the author of The Hottest Water in Chicago, Notes of a Native Daughter. I'm Terry Gross.
On Birmingham Sunday, a noise shook the ground, and people all over the earth turned around. For no one recalled a more cowardly sound, and the choir kept singing of freedom.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from grants provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, why the editorial page editor of the New York Times went fly fishing during his midlife crisis. We talk with Howell Raines about his new fly fishing memoir and about recent changes in the New York Times editorial policy. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.